my shoes too.
Not at all.
Tired.
Okay, well let's start first. Just to be official, say your name, Sam, and when you were born, where your congregation is now.
My name is Samuel B. Radwine. I was born February 29th, 1952, in Taylorville, Illinois. I am now the cantor of the United Jewish Center in Danbury, Connecticut. I've been there for 4 years, starting my fifth. I am also the director of education for the synagogue, in addition to being the cantor.
Tell us, Sam, how did you become involved in the cantorate? What led you to it? What kind of training did you, or musical background did you have?
From several backgrounds. My role model / mentor was actually the rabbi that I grew up with, Myra Bromowitz in Springfield, Illinois, who was not a cantor. We did not have a cantor, although he had been trained in Chazanut and was kolbo in the synagogue, and encouraged me to sing quite a bit, though he had his designs on my being a rabbi, and he liked making little rabbis in his own image. And I thought that that's what I was going to be. I wanted to be a musician. I went to University of Illinois, got a bachelor's degree in music, and was teaching public school music, actually instrumental music. I was not a singer. And decided that I still wanted a career that tied something to do with the Jewish community. And Chazanut seemed to be the answer. Hebrew in college program seemed to be the answer. The problem that I had entering was that I wasn't a singer at the time. I was 24 years old, had really never studied voice formally, although I had sung. I could read music very well, and I had a pleasant voice. It was not trained, and I had a long way to go when I was 24. They accepted me on the provision that that I work on my voice, which is what I did for 5 years. Initially, of course, while I was in school. I studied privately outside of the college, which was expected of everybody.
How much outside
the college
would they expect from people?
There was no quantitative requirement. However, it was just expected that you studied and that you grew vocally outside the college. I studied with the same person weekly for the five years that I was in the college. It was the biggest hurdle I think I've ever had to overcome in my life. I entered HUC with no vocal background in a class with people with master's degrees in voice who had sung opera. And even though I was a musician and I could musically compete, vocally it was very difficult. At the end of my second year, there were those people who had problems, even though I had a good academic record. There were those faculty members who thought I just was not going to be a singer. After consultation with my voice teacher, I found all this out later, wasn't privileged information. My voice teacher said, look, give him a chance. He's a young singer. And he's 2 years old as a singer. And you got to be patient. I was given a chance, and things started to turn around my third year. By the time that I was ready for placement after investiture, I could vocally compete with my class. My vocal growth has continued to this day. I've continued to study with several other people. Mm-hmm. I feel that I'm in a better place now, but I'm still a young singer for my chronological age, which is 33. Mm-hmm. I feel good about the progress that I've made. But because, as I say, it's really been a struggle. It's probably been the greatest struggle I've ever had to deal with in my life. Mm-hmm. Because I was one of these kind of kids that everything sort of came naturally. I really didn't have to study in high school or college, and even at HUC, you know, I just did what I had to do. But this was something that didn't come naturally at all, and I really had to jump into head first, and I think it paid off in the long run.
What was your Jewish background like?
My Jewish background was, it's very hard to say. People always ask me, was I religious? Though they say you must have come from a religious family, and I would say yes, I did. They weren't observant, but they were religious. My mother is what I like to refer to as a Southern Baptist Reformed Jew. She believed in the old time religion and pure faith. I use the term Southern Baptist with tongue in cheek. It would come from a small town in Southern Illinois where there were no other Jews. They were always affiliated with the congregation in Springfield. And I came from a decidedly non-Jewish environment, where an actual Bible Belt environment, where faith and religion was a very integral part of everybody's life. The fact that we happened to be Jews was sort of a minor consequence. And this is the background that my mother came from, and I think I was influenced a lot from that. There was a strong faith structure. There was not that we observed the holidays in the home. There was no kashrut. There was no Shabbat, and occasionally we'd go on Friday night. But religious education was something that was non-negotiable. It was just what we were to do. I never even questioned it. We were driven. We had to be driven 30 miles each way, as if we were driving from Waterbury to Danbury. Okay. If you can imagine that, to Hartford. You know, this is every
in order to go to religious school.
In order to go to religious school and Hebrew school later on too. A mediocre to poor background, but yet I always felt a connection, and I think the connection was because I came from such a decidedly non-Jewish environment where I always felt like an outsider, even though I had friends and I felt comfortable in the community. I was always looking for that connection, and when I got into MFTI, which was MFTI in the Midwest, that connection was definitely there, and that was where the roots built. And I was a
what was that youth group experience like?
It was great. That was like where I first found my group, you know, the people that I really enjoyed being with, and the girls that I wanted to go out with, and you know, this kind of thing. I actually ended up was president of my youth group from 30 miles away. Ended up going to Kutz in my while I was in high school, which was, you know, a major journey and a major revelation, meeting Jews from other parts of the country, people of whom are colleagues of mine today, rabbinic and cantorial. So that's a very interesting background. I ended up marrying somebody who I subsequently divorced, who I met at Kutz, and we had remained in touch, who was from a decidedly more environmentally Jewish background than I was, somebody from New Jersey. But those were real important years. I mean, I consider myself a child of the Reform movement, and even though I'm in a sort of a traditional kind of situation, I feel good about that. I mean, I feel like it gives more validity to Reform to have those of us who came up in that mode, as more and more of us have, to really create a Reform Judaism, a Reform clergy, a Reform cantrip, really.
And yet you say that you're in a very interesting situation where now the show that you're in, the synagogue that you're in, has both a Reform group and a much more traditional group,
right.
And you function as the chazan for each one of those groups.
Yes.
What's that like?
It's sometimes schizophrenic, but in many ways it's very satisfying because, A, it allows me to do a varied range of singing, of davening, of music. I guess my whole philosophy about Reform Judaism is that Reform Judaism isn't based on what we don't do. I mean, it's based on the possibilities that are open to us. And I have the widest range of possibilities of any of my colleagues. Mm-hmm.
Anyone else who's in the same situation as you?
No, I really don't. I know people, I know a lot more of my colleagues, the younger colleagues, who are trying with permission and encouragement from a number of their rabbis to integrate traditional davening into the Reform service, which I think is a great innovation. It doesn't mean that, you know, sometimes the old-time Reformers will say, oh, we're going back to that. I don't think it means we're going back to that. It means that we're looking, you know, we're searching for something that we may find meaningful. I think Reform congregations today are made up largely of people with traditional backgrounds who are searching for those meaningful things. And I think if we as cantors can integrate that stuff into what we do, as well as our own Reform tradition, because we do have a Reform tradition too. I think that it opens up a wide amount of chances for us. So that's what that's what I try to do in all of my services. And
do you approach how do you think your role changes, or does it change? Between when you do the more, quote, Reform services on Friday night or the Reform service on Shabbos morning, as opposed to doing the traditional service earlier on Shabbos morning?
There's a definite difference, one, because it's a different constituency. On Friday night, I'm definitely doing more, quote, singing, unquote. I mean, it's more of an art song kind of approach. And yet, I still go for a large participatory factor within the service, because the people, they want to sing. But it's a different kind of participation. It's a little bit more of a... it's a little bit more passive, but I think that it's active too. There's an emotional participation. I don't think that to sit and listen is not a total passive. I mean, there's active listening, and I think that's the kind of consistency that I'm serving on Friday night. The Saturday morning traditional service, we have daveners. We have old time traditional daveners who are reading and saying fast and don't do a lot of listening, or just kind of trying to be paced. So a lot of times, my role is, I find myself praying for myself sometimes, quite a bit actually.
When you're in a traditional setting?
When I'm in a traditional setting, where I, even more, only because I'm not as busy carrying the message to them. It seems like I'm more like, I'm supposed to be the Shaliach Tzibur, but I haven't really... I don't know that I've really defined it yet exactly which way I'm singing.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we face the Amid faces the congregation and not the Aron, maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know, but it's a smaller group. But they're very even though they're very appreciative. I mean they're sort of all off making Shabbos in their own corner, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
So it's a totally different kind of experience. One that I don't know that I. I'm 100% in agreement with. I have problems with it. I have problems with some of the texts that I don't ideologically agree with. I mean, I always say to the rabbi on the Shalosh Regalim, I said, if I have to sing Umid Nechatuena Galinu Me'artzenu one more time, my nose is going to grow longer.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe these things, and it makes it difficult. There's some of the piyutim are very beautiful and the words are okay and it's poetry and it's all right, but when we get into some of the sacrificial stuff, it's very difficult to approach it from an intellectual level.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have to do is kind of suspend.
So how do you deal with what are other? That's just a very interesting point. So there's one theological point where you said we're exiled from our land.
Yeah.
What's another? Other points where you have trouble theologically with the material.
I have trouble with the with sacrificial cult.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't feel that it has validity in my life or our lives today as American Jews.
So do you have a way that you deal when you do Musaf? How do you deal with that?
Musaf. What ends up with the Musaf is the Musaf, and I train my students. Our traditional service is non-egalitarian, so it's only the boys.
Uh-huh.
This is a very weird situation. It's non-egalitarian because of tradition, not because that's the way that I want it.
Uh-huh.
I would prefer having them. In fact, I've trained some girls to do it, and Alavai, shortly they'll be able to do it. But right now, it's with Derech Eretz to some of the older people who
uh-huh.
really would not have a place to pray if it was. The way I deal with it is. I guess the best instance is melodies maybe take over, and the sound and the effect of the whole, the musaf as a whole, becomes more important than the words that are actually being said.
Sure.
And I guess there is there's a tradition for that too. I mean, if we look at prayers like El Baruch Atal Dea or where we have sort of a mantra sound instead of really having to intellectualize the words, that's been important. So I don't feel bad about doing that. I mean, for instance, like the tune, the paragraph of Yom HaShabbat, Shnei Chasim B'nei Shana Tamimim. We sing a tune. We go V'yom 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 HaShabbat. So we sing the tune. Don't worry about what it says.
And
He's
the
doing,
fact that
we
they're
do
talking
it.
About lambs and sheep.
Yeah, and
say
I'm marching to the slaughter. You know, it just
yeah.
It doesn't. It just doesn't have any relevance, so I forget that. For instance, I don't dwell on it. I read it rather fast. I mean, I daven it. To make it be said. I mean, was it Rashi that said that you or no? Abarbanel who said you do when the the belief will come, do the mitzvah first?
Rosenzweig talks about
I'm saying the words, maybe the belief will come, you know, I don't know. But
you're saying it's Rashi, not Sevi Nishma.
I'm thinking of Rashi. Okay. Yes. All right. That's
we'll do, and then we'll understand.
And then we'll worry about understanding later. Okay. I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, that I do it. I'm sure there would be those who would quarrel with me about that, but right now that's
very interesting.
That's what I have to do.
Sam, what about maybe go in a little different direction and say, where do you tell me a job description of what you do and what do you do in your job?
What do I do? Really, my job is largely educational, and it's a source of conflict for me right now. However,
maybe list off all the different things.
Okay. I'm the principal of the Sinai School and the principal of the Hebrew School. I teach a Dalit Hebrew class. I prepare the B'nai Mitzvah for the time that they're on the Bima. I read Torah every once in a while, and we read a full... We lay in a full Sedra.
We lay in a
full Sedra every week. And every holiday.
Entire Torah portion?
Yes, the entire Torah portion, which means I can't be true to the Trump. It's right now. It takes all my koach to get the Hebrew down.
You have to prepare an entire Sedra, and you're also the Baal Korah.
I only do it once every week. The rabbi does it most of the time, but I will do it occasionally. Uh-huh. I have an adult choir. That I rehearse once a week. I do special programming. I do hospital visiting and life cycle events. In the first chazan in my congregation, I replaced an assistant rabbi educator who became the senior rabbi. And instead of hiring another assistant rabbi, they hired me. So I've had to pick up the slack for a lot of that.
Did you feel good about that?
Very good. I find it very gratifying. I mean, all of these things, all these non-musical things, have really allowed me to touch the congregation in other ways, and build associations that I think even gave me more credibility as a chazan. That when it was time to sing, they were maybe ready to listen even a little bit more. There was a different kind of connection there, and so I like that a lot. Trying to think, but I hate when I have to sit down and list these things. Involved in community affairs, musical groups in the community, interfaith groups. I'm trying to think of a typical week and what it involves. There's a certain amount of administration in the building that goes on that I tend to have to look after. Very involved in the committee structure of the synagogue. Both the rabbi and I make sure between the two of us we cover all committee meetings, and we have a very good... The synagogue that I'm in has a very good committee structure, very active committee structure, very involved in youth committee. We have an active school committee, committee on the arts that does extra programming. That's right now off the top of my head without reading, you know.
How about, talk a little bit, Sam, about the relationship, the rabbi-cantor board triangle, how that works in your situation.
Yeah. It's funny because I never thought of it as a triangle. Is that like God, Torah, and Israel? which is the God. let me address it first, just bilaterally, Rabbi Cantor. I'm in a very fortunate situation with a rabbi who is truly my rov, and friend, and incredible mensch. I look up to him. He also looks up to me. I truly believe that. And that we have this sharing relationship is worth a lot to me.
Do you think that's typical?
I think it's atypical. Mm-hmm. I think most people have Soros. Came from a meeting today of the ACC where there was a lot of time devoted to sitting and complaining about rabbis. Which is usually every meeting like that.
But you were saying in your situation.
In my situation, it's totally the opposite. And there's respect, and there's derecherets from both sides. There's working together. We plan things together, and there's also we can be authentic in front of each other, where sometimes we can't, you know, sometimes we can't be, or we can just sort of, I guess, let down our guard in places that you really can't with the Balabhatim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very special. As far as our relationship with the board, I think because of the relationship we have with each other, I think we both tend to be very protective of each other. And not that we need protecting, but I don't make a move for consulting him. And he's pretty good about consulting me, too. And because we are the professionals, and we have to stand together. We have a good relationship with our board. Our board looks to us for leadership, because that's the tradition that was set in the synagogue. It's a synagogue that had the same rabbi for 46 years.
Right. We should maybe just mention on tape that Jerome Molina was the president of the
president of the CCAR.
Right.
Yeah, and certainly a prominent man, and an incredibly prominent figure, not only in the congregation but in the greater Danbury community itself. So my rabbi walked into big shoes, and I mean, this was a process that they thought of for 10 years before they really came to somebody.
And your congregation has a national reputation.
Yes, exactly. And even though, you know, sometimes when I see things that don't work right, I wonder where did this reputation come from. But no, I think we do, and I take a lot of pride in what we do. And I also take a lot of pride in the fact that we're constantly trying to work on doing better. You know, we a lot of times places sit and they want to rest on their crown laurels, and that's not where we are. I mean, it's a place that looks to growth and struggles and tries to do. But this is it's a process that, with the way, you know, leadership versus, I guess I don't see us in a triangle. I mean, maybe that sounds terrible to say.
Yeah, it doesn't.
But I don't see us. It's not us versus them either. You know, it's we're the leadership, and because that's what they need us to be, that's what they want us to be. We're very clear about that. In a way, there was had sort of a truth time with a small committee recently about, you know, what some of the things that they felt were lacking in me and I felt were lacking in them. And it was a very productive session. There were a lot of things that had festered that people were afraid to say. And it was time to get them out in the open. It was caused by a particular situation, but it ended up very good.
Who set that up?
Who set up
the session? And
the rabbi, the president, and I set it up. And it was really at the rabbi's calling, because we have both found that oftentimes people we'll hear people say, hey, it's great, it's wonderful. We'll hear criticism second and third hand, and we felt that it was time to get some of those things out in the open. One of the things that was transmitted to me that I never realized, that perhaps I was almost a little bit too informal,
mm-hmm.
that I was that they were concerned with my status as the cantor, and I had never perceived that, and I found it interesting, only because I don't run around telling everybody to call me by my first name. I mean,
what were some of the issues, if you'd like to share them, that were
the issues
in terms of the cantorate? And
I think the issues were stature in the community. And it's funny because I tend to be more of a formal person. One of the issues was having adults call me by my first name. But when people ask me, I say whatever you're comfortable with, thinking if they need to call me Cantor and they need me to be Cantor, then that's fine. If they feel that that's stilted, they want a little bit closer relationship and want me by my first name, that's fine. Children, it's always Cantor Radwine. There's never a question. But there seemed to be a perception that there was something with the statue. And I still haven't figured it out yet. It's still a little bit of a mystery to me. I consider myself fairly in touch as far as that's concerned, and I'm still working on this one, so the reports aren't all in yet. But what was good about the situation, we were able to enter into honest dialogue, and it was because of, I think, at the urging of the rabbi. That's,
How do you feel? You mentioned earlier that that you had considered becoming a rabbi and going back and forth on Rabbi Cantor. What were some of the factors that infused your decision, and just some of the ways that you reflect on
it? It was very simple, because oftentimes I sit kind of on the other side of the fence and look, because I love study, and I would have liked to have done some of the things that the rabbis did in school. I would have liked to have been studying with Martin Cohn and Gene Borowitz, and The rabbis, the cantors are doing that now today. I mean, like, sometimes I almost think if I had another 5 years of my life to waste, I'd go back and start over again. But I always wanted to be able to do those kind of things. I didn't want to be cantor Am HaAretz. However, I was a musician first. That was consideration number one. Number two, I don't have a lot of self-confidence as far as being verbally articulate and struck with the terror of standing up with something vital to say week after week. And I still am. Even though I do sermons on occasion, I do, especially if the rabbis aren't there, I'll drash on Saturday morning, which I'm becoming more and more comfortable with. Usually if I preach Friday night, it's a musical sermon, what we call a sermon and song, where we speak on a certain topic that's tied together with musical selections. Because that's what I'm most comfortable with. You talk about what you know, and that's what I know. But as I say, sometimes I sit and look across the fence and see what do the rabbis do. And I think I've come to the conclusion that just because I'm a cantor doesn't preclude doing that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Into another sort of different area, where do you go for your material? Where do you find the music that you use?
I guess, over the years, you collect probably about 99% more than what you ever end up using. You have your filing system, you have and things that come across your desk, either in the mail or new publications, whatever. And when the need arises, I go to one of those places and say, okay, I need something of this genre. Let me see what I can find. It's usually there. Because I say I have things and files that I've never looked at. And the files get bigger, and as the usage, you just don't change all that much. But as far as individuals that I go to, is that part of it?
Yeah, different places, individuals.
I think that, of course, it depends what I'm doing. I tend to go, like for instance, Friday night, which is really where I'm trying to do the more programmatic kind of material. Ben Steinberg is a favorite of mine, for instance, merely because Ben knows how to turn a tune. And a tune is what people hang on to. Now, it can't just be a tune. There are people like Saul Zinn who can do tunes too. I hate Saul Zinn because it comes off sounding trite. Hate's a strong word. Don't care for him. So. Ben's music, on the other hand, combines the recognizable with art, with decoration, and with the... and then I also have to think about what sounds good for my voice. I don't have a dramatic voice. I don't have a traditional Chazonic voice. And I have to go for something that's rather lyrical on the easy side. I sound best when I'm doing something more lyrical and simple. So that's a consideration to go to. And it all seems to come together.
In terms of other sources for material, do you have publication societies that you look to, or
Transcontinental sends a lot of they send music out when they publish it. Fortunately, a lot of it's unusable. Uh-huh. I think whenever anything comes across my desk, I'll buy it.
Uh-huh.
I feel strongly about that. Books, Tara does a lot of good publishing. Whenever I go into even just Jay Levine's, I'll just happen to look through the music racks and see what's there. If there's something, sometimes it's something old that he has and he's probably had there for 30 years, that I'll buy, just because I don't remember having it in my library. As far as the Israeli tunes like there were in the early 70s, those aren't happening anymore, unfortunately, and I don't really use those.
What do you think of Israeli music now?
Well, as the guy said last night, it's hard to, how do you characterize Israeli music? It's like, how do you characterize American music? It's hard to say. I think most of the Israeli music that I've been in touch with in late years has been some chamber and instrumental music, which I'm very fond of. A few choral arrangements here and there. Yechezkel Bron, which I use a lot of, is fabulous. I think he's one of the most sensitive choral arrangers I've ever come in contact with. I don't use it. I enjoy, popular Israeli cabaret music, things with Yemenite and Greek influence. But that's not really usable for the synagogue. Those are just things that I enjoy personally. Um, But as far as like the Hasidic festival tunes, which of course made a big hit in the early and middle 70s in America, those aren't happening anymore. Mm-hmm. And I just really can't use them.
How about, this is a, in another vein, when you were being Shaliach Tzibur for a group, what are you leading tefillah? What are you trying to do with that group? Where do you want to, do you want to take them anywhere? What kind of effect do you want them to have in going through a service? And how does your role?
I don't know that I've ever put my finger on it. Again, it depends on the kind of group. It depends on the time. It depends on the setting. It depends on me. It depends on how I'm feeling. My favorite thing to sing all year is Baruch Hashanah. Baruch Hashanah Yichatevun, V'yom Tzom Kippur Yichatemun. And Unatana Tokef, you know, before that. What I find ends up happening, I always get comments on, is I end up taking myself someplace. I mean, I sort of take myself otherworldly. And I find people come with me. It's one of the few times of the year that it happens.
Why do you think it happens then, I mean, as opposed to on a Kabbalah Shabbat?
People needed to. I needed to.
People need that spiritual
experience. It's very intense. People come to look for it. I mean, it's no secret that people pour into shul on Yom Tov, and, you know, more than on Shabbos. And yet on Shabbos, too, there are times when a lot of it depends. Yeah, I get a lot of energy from the congregation. And a lot of it depends sometimes, because maybe this sounds like a cop-out, but sometimes it depends on what kind of energy I'm getting. I mean, if I'm getting energy that says, you know, take us, I will. Sometimes I don't get energy, and I have to either decide to do it myself, or I just sing the words and leave the bima and go home. You know, I mean, that happens. Unfortunately, that happens more times than not. But what's nice is when you know what those peak experiences are like, when it's time to go there, you know, at least you have some kind of point of reference.
Uh-huh.
I've never been able to put my finger on, you know, where we're going, where, you know, what that is.
Should the music serve the liturgy in a special way?
Don't understand your question.
How do you decide if certain tunes are better for you for certain prayers than others? Or how do you?
Well, part of it, I think the main factor there is my own aesthetic sense. I mean, things have to they have to work for me. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to sing them.
Uh-huh.
The second requirement is they have to work for the congregation. For instance, there's a Pepe Vishamru that I've been trying to introduce. We call it Sondheim Vishamru, even though it was written by Richie Nadel. Because Vishamru v'nei Yisrael et ha-shabbat la'asot et ha-shabbat l'dorotam berito. The congregation hates it. I just don't get a response. I'm probably going to throw it out. I've used it a lot. I mean, you know, you have to do things over and over again to get, and I realize they just don't like it. And, you know, it's jarring. My congregation they need to be soothed. They need, they want a little, I don't like to call it hot tub, but, you know, they've been running, and they want their Shabbos on Friday night. And the fact that they do come to shul for it and don't go for it at home, they really do want to sit. And they want to be thrilled at certain places, but somehow right there, that doesn't make it. So I know, I just know to get rid of it. I happen to like it. I thought it was a catchy tune. I know it's not going to make it, so I'll get rid of it.
Uh-huh.
There's an Ahavat Olam that I use. It's Yecheskel Bran, and I've got a lovely soprano in my choir. She starts out with a solo, and it goes into this whole choral kind of fugue, and I can see they beg me to sing this. You know, they really want that, and that was very new, and that caught on just like that. You know. You just have to know. You got to have that sense. You got to talk. You got to hear people. I like when people. I write a regular column in the our bulletin, and I always say to people over and over again, talk to me about the service. Tell me when you hate something. Tell me when you like something.
Mm-hmm.
But let's discuss it. You know, there are times when I'm going to tell them what I think is good for them too. I mean, you know, But all in all, it's a, you know, it's a give and take process.
Where is God in the equation? Where does God fit in?
It's so hard to put in words. It's those moments. It's those peak experiences. Those real good moments. You know. That you kind of come home and, you know, you say that was it. Sometimes it's like you have to take a step back from it before to just, you know, just describing, you know, what, like, you know, was God in this place, and surely did I know it or did I not, you know. And more times than not, I don't think about it, which isn't good, of course. We get bogged down in the mechanical. We get bogged down in the staging and the show business and the theater. And I don't like that, but what I like is the fact maybe every once in a while I can stop myself and say, whoa, you know, there's something more important going on here. I think it depends where I go with it. You know, when I get most introspective, I can't always find it with them. Usually I have to kind of get to God myself. I remember one Shabbat in the traditional service I was particularly angry because there was just a lot of kibitzing. I have colleagues who blame on that Ahmed, you know, or, I mean, that's not me. The emeritus would stare. I mean, he would just stop and stare, and I've done that too, you know. But I'm just not that type. So I simply turned around and finished davening facing the Aron, and shut everybody out, and just said, "Let's go for it myself." And afterwards, I said, "Oh, Ken, it was wonderful. You sing so great." And it was like, you know, it was such a prayerful feeling, and. I guess what had happened was, even though I was very angry, what had happened was, you know, I need to pray. It wasn't a matter of listening to me. It was a matter of, I need to pray, and you guys are screwing around out here. And I'm really pissed, you know. So I just turned around and did it. And I didn't do it again because the rabbi got pissed. He says, look, you know, we got to be a little consistent. He was right. I mean, we have a consistency to make and to keep to, and that's what we got to do. But it was just that one time, and I just, you know, fuck you. I turned around. You know, it had that effect. So I guess, as I say, I guess the answer is that I go there myself and hope that everybody follows. I mean, how do we know? How do you know that they're going to follow you? You don't. You just have to do your best job. We have a lot of non-believers, too. I mean, that's a big part of it. People don't come to find God.
Why do you think people come?
A lot of different reasons. They come to relax. They come for an undefined spiritual experience. They don't necessarily connect with God. They come for the peoplehood. I think peoplehood is number one.
Community.
Yeah, community. You know, I guess after I was first introduced to Jewish philosophy and modern philosophers and tried to define myself, and I said, you know, I realized that. I was ideologically probably with Buber, for all practical senses, followed Kaplan, and which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it really has. That's kind of remained a constant for me, in my years as a Jewish professional. That the peoplehood is what kind of, you know, makes everything solidify. But yet I'm still always looking for that eye of thou and trying to reach it.
How about in terms of an age perspective? We talked a little bit before we started the interview about a perspective about the cantorial concert, and how do you see a difference in the older people in the profession as opposed to the younger people coming up?
It's hard to generalize because you really can't.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, the tendency is to say, well, we younger people are very with it and they're out of date. It's not true. There's some very talented with it older chazanim who are even retired now, who had their fingers on things. I see the American Reform Cantor as being such a new institution that we've been struggling for the last three decades, or it has been struggling, I shouldn't say we, because I've just started the struggle, there's been a great struggle to try to find some kind of sense of identity, to know who we are and to know what our mission is. I think maybe my mission is different than somebody maybe who's been out for 20 years, a lot of people. I hate to make a judgment, because I don't know, you know, I don't think I know enough to make a judgment. The things that I'm looking for in my in my cantorate are different than somebody else is looking for, looking to do, looking for objectives. So I really can't answer that, you know, fairly. I see a lot of people who are older than me who are doing things that I just would not do, that don't fit with my idea of what I want to do. And yet they're very successful. And yet I think I'm successful too. So, again, it's not an answerable question.
How about just some of your reaction to some specific things? Maybe you heard at the CCAR convention recently, Gunther Plaut came out and said that the reform movement should do away with Friday night services and everybody should be home Friday night, having Shabbos dinner and making Kiddush and singing Zemiris with their families. What's your reaction to that?
The very first reaction is, gee, wouldn't that be nice? Pragmatically, it's foolish, as I think his colleagues came to let him know in a rather unceremonious fashion. It's interesting because the rabbi and I have often talked about what if we did a 6 o'clock traditional Kabbalat Shabbat and went home. You know, just said once, like in the middle of the winter when there was nothing else going on. And he keeps talking, every time he brings it up, I said, you've been threatening to do this for 4 years. All right, do it already, you know. I think Friday night services is an institution that's here. It serves a great need of a great many people. And it's important. It's very important. It's not going to bring people into Saturday morning. That's just not the kind of world we live in. People have other things to do oftentimes on Saturday morning. It's not going to enforce it, or I should say the things that they want to do. And by doing that, it's not going to bring them in the synagogue. You get them when you can. For myself, I mean, there's another aspect of it. I'm single. I like having someplace to have Shabbat. I have my Shabbat at the synagogue. If I was home, I wouldn't. I used to light candles by myself. That was depressing, you know. So I don't do it anymore. But there are a lot of people like me that need that place to go on Friday night. And God forbid we should get rid of it. I mean, sure, you know, we say, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could fix people up and have people over at other... That doesn't work. It doesn't always work. I like having some place to go on Friday night.
What's your experience like in the community, being single and being a chazan? Do you feel a certain amount of social pressure? Is there pressure from the congregation? Or is it hard to date, you know? Or
it's difficult. It's very difficult. There's certain pressures that are very difficult.
In terms of we were just talking about how the congregation perceives you and how do you feel that they let you go on with your own life, or do they want to become involved?
I think generally they do let me go on. You know, there's a certain element that does want to know what's under the robe, you know, which is I guess just a universal problem, and a curious as to what I'm doing and where I'm going. But generally, most people have the respect and the politeness to allow me to do what I need to do. And when people step over their bounds, the bounds that I've drawn, the bounds that I think should be there, there are very polite and very subtle ways of letting them know. I remember recently, you know, a woman who really does step these bounds quite regularly said something about, so why aren't you married yet? You know, and I said, well, I tried it and it didn't work, so, you know. So just kind of, you know, put an end to that conversation real quickly.
Here's another question. In terms of what's your reaction to more and more women coming into the cantoret? I've heard a couple people say that looking at the percentage of women in HUC now, that down the line the cantoret might be a woman's profession. What are your reactions to that?
It's not an issue for me. It really isn't. I mean, the class that I was invested with was five women and myself. I've never known anything else but women in the profession. It just isn't an issue. I mean, I don't see it men versus women. I don't see one kind. I see it cantors, you know, qualified cantors versus unqualified cantors. It just doesn't. I mean, it's probably less of an issue for me than maybe it is for some women cantors. I don't know. I just it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple closing questions. Is it possible to make a living now in the cantorate? How do people feel about that?
I'm comfortable. I have what I need. If I had a family, it'd be harder. Except if I had a family, probably my wife would work. You really don't make as much as a lot of your congregants, especially your leadership, because they're genuinely professionals, doctors, lawyers. And the size of the congregations that we work at, that's more the rule. So sometimes you sit and you drool up a house and a nicer car. As I say, I am comfortable, and I feel like for my needs right now, you know, and providing that my salary escalates in the way that it has, I really have no complaints. As I say, maybe my perspective would be different if I was married.
Do you, just as a last question, are there any questions about the cantorate? The state of the cantorate right now, or your position in the cantorate that I haven't asked you that are important that I should have asked.
All right. I think the biggest issue for me now is sometimes I feel as if the cantorate has become the totality of my life, and I look for something to escape from it, to do something totally different, so that I'm refreshed when I come back. And finding time for that is sometimes an issue for me. I mean, I think every profession has it. You know, everybody tries to do something else. I haven't liked to cook, and I've been sort of doing it as an avocation, and sort of on a catering sort of thing on the side. I mean, just doing small dinner parties and things for people, and that's a real escape for me. I mean, I work, and when I do something like that, I really work very hard. But it just, I'm refreshed when I come out of it, because it's just been something totally different and very gratifying. And then I'm ready to go back to my position. And I guess I haven't made peace with that having to run to something else. Not that it's taking, you know, because it's not taking. I'm not looking to make a big killing in this. Just looking to sort of enjoy myself. And sometimes I feel a little bit guilty, like, you know, maybe I should be doing something else at this time. But I'll deal with it.
Great.